So we have Ed Morris from Gossamer Security. Is there a solution for the interface? Okay, Gossamer Security. And he's going to talk about the ever interesting topic, entropy. Take it away.
Thanks, Nithya. So as Nithya mentioned, I'm Ed Morris. I'm with Gossamer Security. My apologies for being late. I was in another presentation, and with the times a little bit off, things got kind of a little bit out of hand. So thanks for patience for anyone who's waiting. This presentation, again, my apologies as well. Kai couldn't be here. There was an urgent matter that he had to tend to, but he will be present for his presentation, I think, after lunch. So have no fear. You can see that we've got an overview, the topics that we'll kind of be covering during this presentation. And I think that, you know, entropy is obviously the subject, and the boogeyman is sort of the part of the presentation title. We'll cover a little bit here in the background just about entropy, the measure of unpredictability, the underpinning. But just I want to take a moment to talk about sort of the genesis for this presentation. It's sort of been a few years in the making, and it started with my entrance back into FIPS after a short time out of it a few years ago, and looking at some of the entropy systems that we were working with. And so this presentation sort of tracks along with my growth of understanding, my increase in the understanding, but also this growing concern about what I was sort of recommending to vendors on entropy and how necessary was it. And it wasn't a concern that it isn't necessary, it was just a concern that I didn't have a good grasp on how necessary is it. And we all know that entropy is the sort of the bedrock of cryptography. Without it, you don't have good cryptography. And if you have poor entropy, it can undermine your security. But really, the question that was forming in my mind was to what degree? And more importantly, with what consequences? That was the part that I really didn't have a good feel on, but as I kind of went through, and as we go through the presentation, hopefully you'll experience the kind of the enlightenment that I did and sort of get a better feel for how much of a difference does it really make. When I first began kind of learning about entropy, we'll go through some of the standards. I sort of had this sneaking suspicion that if your entropy is not good enough, well, that's it, game over. And so I kind of likened that to a boogeyman. It's sort of, you know, this thing that you tell your kids, if you don't brush your teeth, if you don't do your homework, the boogeyman's going to get you. And then, of course, you've got sleepless children, which is probably not the desired effect. But there's this entropy boogeyman in my mind who was kind of growing and growing, and I wasn't really sure, is there really such a boogeyman? And you hear a lot about entropy, and that's what I was unsure of. So let's talk a little bit about some of the background, and once we get that material out of the way, we can get into the more interesting matter. There's several different measures of entropy. You've got Shannon entropy, sort of classical. You've got Rene entropy. You've got minimum entropy. I won't actually touch on the details of those. My interest only lay in minimum entropy because that's what the FIPS program laid out. That's also what's used in common criteria here within the U.S. So we'll accept that the minimum entropy is sort of a more conservative estimate of entropy. And again, there's that conservatism to make sure that we're not going to have too little entropy. And of course, if you have too little entropy, bad things can happen. When looking at some of the different standards that actually govern it and we kind of try to use to assess entropy, I still remember the die-hard tests. That was NIST SB 822 kind of codified those. You have FIPS 140-1, which actually has some statistical tests itself back in 94. The German AIS 20 standard, that went through a revision later on, the 2031 standard. That took a much more methodical approach going through the different types of random number generators. And so you can see things improving in 2011. And then NIST released SB 800B in August 2012. And obviously that last standard is still under revision, but it sort of builds a little bit or extends, I think, on the AIS 20 and 31 in terms of the approach. However, the statistical tests themselves are still being tweaked or discussed in order to provide the best estimate of entropy, as well as the best estimate of the uncertainty in entropy, which I think is a sticking point. So in my learning about those, the key takeaway that I had is that assessing entropy is hard. There's a lot of math. There's a lot of statistics. It's not to be taken lightly. there's a lot of good examples of the number pi, the rational number pi, being fed into the statistical suite to see how good is its entropy. And it's surprisingly good. Doesn't make it a very good choice for your random number generator, but it's surprisingly good when assessed with the different statistical tests. So looking at all of that, again, my impression was entropy boogeyman. You know, entropy's hard. If you don't do it right, he's going to get you. So let's look a little bit at what I kind of delved into next, which was the actual architecture, I call it, of entropy. This sort of follows directly from 890B. We can see, over here we've got an entropy source bounded by the rectangle. That's composed of a noise source, maybe some method of sampling that noise source, as well as perhaps a conditioning component that can be used to smooth or whiten the output of the noise source. From that noise source, we're going to extract a seed for different random bit generators, random number generators that are in the overall product that's being examined. In this case, we've got three different branches with three different random number generators. And ultimately, the purpose of those random number generators from a cryptography point of view is to generate keys. And so we've got an elliptic curve key pair on the left, we've got a plain old AES key pair in the middle, and an RSA 2048. This diagram here is probably fairly representative of what you'd see in a full product. Maybe a cryptographic library might be a little bit simpler, but this is generally what you expect to see and be able to kind of categorize in this fashion. Let's talk a little bit about each of the components, just for some more background. Hardware, noise sources, some examples there, ring oscillators, voltage oscillators, noisy diodes. There's a number of different ones. Each have their advantages, perhaps, in terms of the silicon real estate it requires. The quality of entropy that you can get from them. When it comes to software noise sources, generally this comes down to timing variations in clocks. So you've got either a real-time clock or a high precision counter within the CPU that you're using to take measurements and then difference those measurements and derive some entropy from that. Types of whitening or conditioning that we commonly see to actually take those raw samples from the noise and sort of smooth them out a little bit. You might have unbiasing. You may have some kind of condensing, XORing or folding in some fashion. More often you'll see a pool where you're doing stirring involving perhaps a hash algorithm. And you've also got linear feedback shift registers. Those are used in the Linux kernel random number generator, which we'll talk about additionally. So kind of with those components from a laboratory point of view, which was ultimately my perspective, the method that we would use to actually assess the raw samples was Tim Hall's, and still is, Tim Hall's Python tool, which approximates, which actually implements the draft 890B statistical tests. Okay. Just to make sure, for the background purposes, here's the random bit generators that we typically come into contact with both FIPS for FIPS modules. You can see at the top we've got some of the older ones, the legacy, and of course there's presentations about the demise of those in 2016 and the effects of that, which will be non-trivial. I've also highlighted of importance the security strength of them, because each one has an associated security strength, and that ties into the type of keys that you can safely generate with that random bit generator. And you can see that we've got an AES 256 based one that's actually nominally a security strength of 256, although it's probably not as cryptographically secure as some of the 800-90 DRBGs. There was one other DRBG that was on the slide originally. It was a dual elliptic curve DRBG. But I left that off because I couldn't figure out how strong it really was, so that doesn't appear on this slide. And in addition to the actual random bit generators, we have to look at the keys we're going to generate. And for some of those keys, it's actually fairly straightforward to figure out what the strength is. Notwithstanding the weak keys within DES, kind of knocking their bit strength down a bit, security strength down a bit, we can see with AES, it correlates to the size of the key. For asymmetric keys, it's a little bit more involved, and it comes down to the difficulty of factoring a large integer into its prime components, or the discrete logarithm problem. But you can see here that for an EC key, it's basically half of the nominal size of the curve. And for RSA, you can kind of match it up along here. Okay, So with all of those kind of pieces, those building blocks of how to analyze the entropy architecture, my next step was to go and actually do that. Looking at different products, understanding how it's actually implemented, carving that up. And that's where I started to see some problems. And that's interesting because, okay, those are things you don't want to have. Obviously, you don't want to have problems. You want to have a good design. So what were some of those problems that we saw? First off, you can see I've diagrammed the slide that we saw before. I stated that this was probably a moderate example of what you might see in a product. Might be a little bit simpler if it's a crypto library. But many times you'd be looking at more of a system. And if it's a system built on perhaps general purpose OS, what I just showed you before kind of becomes part of the picture. But as you explore a little bit more, you find out, oh yes, there actually is a kernel driver component because we have to do that at the kernel level. And we're not sure how that's actually seeded or what its entropy source is. And oh yes, the web server runs atop Java. So that's actually a different, and well, that just comes from wherever Java gets it from. So I guess go look in the security properties file. You may have, well, we actually bolted on just for the secure file transfer another library over there. And there are some other user components, but those are optional features. And by the time you sort of get done with the question and answer phase, the situation can be a lot more complex. And of course, any broken link in this is going to be kind of a potential security vulnerability. What's the next problem that we kind of find? Well, I've taken the original slide here and I've redrawn it painstakingly in PowerPoint, I'll add. And I've drawn it such that the actual size of the different blocks have been made proportional to their cryptograph, to the actual strengths, their bit strengths. And this is helpful to kind of do a visual inspection, if you will. If we look on the path on the left, which was our generation of an elliptic curve key, you can see we've got a nice kind of triangle shape over there. We've got 440 bits of seeding material, which if we assume is, you know, has full entropy. We're feeding that into a 256-bit security strength random bit generator. And from that, we're generating a 192-bit elliptic curve key security strength. That looks good. On the far right, we've got a similar situation. It's almost more of a rectangle, but again, we've got 192 bits of seeding material, 128-bit RNG, and an RSA 2048-bit key has 112 bits of strength. When we look at the middle, that's where we get sort of a problem. And this is kind of what I refer to as a bottleneck. We've got 512 bits of seeding material, that's great, but we have too small an RNG. And oftentimes, you see this in older crypto modules, as well as in kernel components that have too small or too old an RBG. And so the AES key that we're generating from that is too weak. It claims to have 250 bits of strength, but from a cryptanalysis point of view, it can't. It can only have 128. So that's kind of a weakness there that one can find. And you can identify that, and as a vendor, you want to fix that. But that still didn't tell me how bad of a flaw is that. Can that be exploited? What's that going to be? Looking further, you can actually look at the noise source and the noise source itself. Well, I may have heard that this is a really big, bad noise source. It generates lots of high-quality entropy. But upon closer inspection and maybe with some testing, you find out it's more of an itty-bitty noise source. And that, of course, throws into question the entire entropy architecture itself. How many bits of entropy are you really seeding with, and is that enough? And you crunch the numbers, and you can sort of ensure that it is enough. And if not, perhaps you oversample. There are ways to kind of correct that. We'll talk about some of those later. So your noise source is too small, so you had an entropy bottleneck, right? Does the boogeyman get you? Do your keys spill out onto the internet? Do hackers deface your web pages? What happens? I still hadn't really grappled or gotten a good answer to that question. Some takeaways, though, just from the design analysis that we saw in practice. Hardware sources are generally fine. I know that's a sweeping sort of blanket categorization, but if someone's going to take the time to develop a piece of silicon, generally they're going to put some thought into how they do that and make sure they do it right. That doesn't mean you can't have someone who's done it wrong, but in general, I think hardware is better than software. Software lends itself to sort of a DIY approach. I'm going to write up some code. I'm going to sprinkle in some stuff. I'm going to sample my clock. And then I'm going to use that as my entropy. It's perfectly unguessable. That's often not the case. Oftentimes, you may be using too many bits and assuming too much entropy. And there are many cases where we've seen where the statistical testing with the Python tools will uncover and evidence that. And that's quite useful. That's a useful feature of going through this process. All right. So that sort of took me through to about maybe last year or perhaps 6 months prior to that in terms of my own evolution of understanding. And it wasn't until maybe last year's ICMC, in which there was a presentation on entropy, and I happened to be sitting next to John Kelsey, or nearby to him, near enough to be able to ask him some questions and sort of banter during the during the actual presentation. And what I learned, I've got summarized on this slide. So what we did in our lab was we took a random bit generator. We used an AES-256 counter mode DRBG. We seeded it with a known good source that had passed statistical testing, and then we generated a 128-bit AES key, and that's shown up there in red. Then we took that same DRBG, but this time we initialized it with only a seed that only had approximately 40, actually a little less than 40 bits of entropy. And then we generated a second AES key. You can see the second key right there. So I'll pause for a second, give you guys time to see if you can spot the weakness in the second key. Okay. Rather than shouting it out, I'll just ask for a show of hands. How many have spotted the weakness? If you knew, pardon, if you knew. So to be fair, it wasn't a 40-bit seed. It was a full seed for the DRBG, but it only contained an estimated 40 bits of entropy. Exactly. It's a source that's known to have whatever quality, and 256 bits of it equate to about 40 bits of entropy. Right, so so that's kind of the point, and maybe phrased in sort of an unfair fashion, sort of a leading question. But the answer is you really can't spot the weakness. It's a symmetric key. It's a large blob. If you know enough about the construction of that, if you knew how it's put together, if you know that the seed source was actually the process ID stapled to another component and all put together, then you can begin to try and attack it offline by cleverly taking pieces of each of those and looking for examples and then attacking it. It's sort of like cracking a password. You don't just randomly guess passwords. You take the letters that make the most sense. You perform a dictionary attack. But with a symmetric key, if you have 40 bits of entropy in a large seed and it's diffused and within that seed, and you initialize your DRBG, the whitening that you get results in a key that's indistinguishable from another key. And so I submit that there really is no good way other than just brute force. But now if you're brute forcing and you have no idea about the construction of it, there's no shortcut you can take. And that's, I think, effectively what John had said to me, which was at last year's conference, which was, yep, if you've got about 40 bits of good entropy and you see the DRBG and you generate a symmetric key, an attacker's really going to be no better off. There's no attack that attacker can do without other knowledge of how you're constructing your seed to be able to take advantage of that. And that's sort of powerful, right? 40 bits, well, that's a lot less than 128 bits. And yet, no boogeyman. But I didn't fully understand and fully grasp the significance of the symmetric key until I started looking further at asymmetric keys. And symmetric keys are kept hidden. You don't really broadcast them. You might not, as an attacker, you might not have an access to a lot of them unless you've got a device within your control that you can sort of look at. But when you get into public keys, that's where things get a little bit trickier. So let's look at some of the examples of public vulnerabilities for public keys and due to weak entropy. The Netscape SSL random number generator, you can see that it was composed of four different parts, and those weren't terribly random. This wasn't a very good choice, and also this was 1995, so to be fair, that's 20 years ago. But you can see that an attacker can begin guessing those by making a guess at the seconds and the microseconds, and then also the PID and the parent ID as well. Fast forward to 2008, there was an OpenSSL bug. The bug itself was a coding error, if you will, that ended up having the effect that the seed was now just the process ID with nothing else. Well, again, you can start guessing that, begin calculating what the possibilities are, and then figure out what all the random numbers for a given system would be. And that's a lot cheaper, quicker, and easier to do than just a straight brute force attack, which, again, with a symmetric key, you can't do. The MyFair cards from NXP, that the RNG was a 16-bit, produced a 16-bit output, and that RNG was an LFSR-based, I believe, that was dependent upon the time that you read it. And if you could control that time accurately enough, you could get reproducible random numbers. It's not really until 2012 that we get some of the interesting work, and this really focuses on public keys, and this is where you have to be careful with your entropy. So in 2012, both the Ron was right, Witt was wrong, but more importantly, the mining your P's and Q's, those analyses were presented. And the latter is the more comprehensive because it includes some very useful insights into why perhaps these keys were clashing. So let's take a look at some of those because these are the shocking headlines you sort of read about when sipping your morning coffee. So a survey of all the publicly available keys. Again, you can go and query the internet for these. It takes a little bit of ingenuity, takes a lot of storage. But their findings were that 5.5% of TLS host keys share their keys with another host. Almost 10% of SSH keys share public keys. It's pretty shocking. But let's remove default keys from devices that, by default, share keys. And yes, if you don't change your user or admin password, if you don't change the default key, you're going to share keys with someone else. That significantly reduced the number. But still, 0.75% of the TLS certs shared keys. And they attributed that not to sort of having multiple servers that are working round robin to service requests, but actually to entropy that's too low during the key generation process. And furthermore, there's another 1.7% of the certificates that came from the same faulty implementation based on information in the certificates. Things get even worse, though, because of insufficient entropy. What they further found was that 0.5% and 0.03% of TLS and SSH keys could be, the RSA keys, could be actually cracked. They were actually able to take all these different keys and find out that in many cases, the modulus, there was a shared prime between them. And through greatest common divisor, through some clever ways to kind of compute the GCD between these two moduli, they were able to actually factor it and thus crack the keys. That's very bad news. It's also bad news to share a key with another server as well, but I think it's even worse to be just flat out cracked. And for DSA keys with SSH, they were also able to crack those based on the repeated K value in the signature during the authentication process. So let's dig a little bit more, because certainly this appears to be the boogeyman, you know, really having his influence and making a big difference. Okay, so when you start digging further, and the authors, I credit them for actually providing this analysis, DevURandom, that's being used to seed. And DevURandom versus DevRandom, for those who have looked at the Linux kernel random number generator, DevURandom makes no guarantee of good quality entropy. It's unblocking, it runs off an LSFR with the extraction process, and it can give you an infinite amount of data if you read from it, even when the system believes it has no entropy left. There's also what they term as the boot time entropy hole. This is a situation where at early boot, the DevURandom device won't actually seed itself with any available entropy until there's a threshold level. So as you boot your system up and it's collecting entropy, and this is specific to Linux, Unix devices, usually that entropy would be mixed in, but because of this boot time, because of the threshold, DevURandom actually won't have any entropy in it. So those two things combined with early key generation led to keys that either had the exact same primes in their RSA modulus or had a shared prime and perhaps one different prime. And they looked at the actual key generation process and figured out that the way OpenSSL, which is typically going to be used in some of these open source devices, generates these primes. The first one may actually occur within the boot time hole and thus be shared amongst all devices, but there's enough entropy that trickles in between that process and the way the extraction process works to randomize it for the second factor. And that's what led to a number of keys that have a shared prime, which could be cracked just from their analysis. The DropBear SSH server was also, they kind of identified as a possible culprit for the DSA signature leakage, if you will, in the K value. And the way DropBear sort of works is it goes in early at boot time, grabs its own bits of entropy, puts them into its own internal pool, and then continues to run with that pool without necessarily reseeding it later through runtime. And as a result, the K values could be predictable and would repeat. So I submit that these problems aren't the ones I was expecting. This isn't the boogeyman. These are, I would say, very broken implementations, right? You're generating a cold boot, your keys, you're taking from DevURandom, you're really taking no precautions. So that's not really the smoking gun, and that's not really the boogeyman that I thought I was going to find.